And half a mile below, and 12 hours earlier, George Dorn and Stella Maris were smoking some Olimit black hash with Harry Coyne.
You haven't got a bad punch for an intellectual,
Coyne said with warm regard.
You're pretty good at rape yourself,
George replied.
For the world's most incompetent assassin.
Coyne started to draw back his lip in an angry snarl, but the hash was too strong.
Hagbod told you, Ace?
He asked bashfully.
He told me most of it,
George said.
I know that everybody on this ship once worked for the Illuminati directly or for one of their governments. I know that Hagbard has been an outlaw for more than 2 decades.
23 years, exactly,
Stella said archly.
That figures,
George nodded.
23 years, then. I never killed anybody until that incident with the spider ships 4 days ago.
Oh, he killed us,
Harry said dreamily, drawing on the pipe.
What he does is worse than capital punishment while it's going on. I can't say I'm the same man I was before, but it's pretty bad until you come through.
I know,
George grinned.
I've had a few samples myself.
Hagbard's system,
Stella said,
is very simple. He just gives you a good look at your own face in a mirror. He lets you see the puppet strings. It's still up to you to break them. He's never forced anyone to do anything that goes against their heart. Of course,
she frowned in concentration.
He does sort of maneuver you into places where you have to find out in a hurry just what your heart is saying to you. Did he ever tell you about the Indians?
The Shoshone?
George asked.
The cesspool gag?
Let's play a game,
Coyne interrupted, sinking lower in his chair as the hash hit him harder.
One of us in this room is a Martian, and we've got to guess from the conversation which one it is.
Okay,
Stella said easily.
Not the Shoshone,
she told George.
The Mohawk.
You're not the Martian.
Coyne giggled.
You stick to the subject, and that's a human trait.
George, trying to decide if the octopus on the wall was somehow connected with the Martian riddle, said,
I want to hear about Hagbard and the Mohawk. Maybe that'll help us identify the Martian. You think up good games,
he added kindly,
for a guy who was sent on 7 assassination missions and fucked up every one of them.
I'm dumb, but I'm lucky,
Coyne said.
There's always somebody else there blasting away at the same time. Politicians are awfully unpopular these days, Ace.
This was a myth Hagbard had confided to George. Until Harry Coyne had completed his course in the Chilean system, it was better if he believed himself the world's most unsuccessful assassin rather than face the truth, that he had goofed only on his first job, Dallas, November 22, 1963, and really had killed 5 men since then. Of course, even if Hagbard wasn't a holy man any longer, he still was tricky. Maybe Harry had indeed missed every time. Perhaps Hagbard was keeping the image of Harry as mass murderer in George's mind to see if George could relate to the man's present, instead of being hung up on his past.
At least I've learned this much,
George thought.
The word past is always in quotes for me now.
The Mohawk,
Stella said, leaning back lazily. George's male organ, or penis, or dick, or whatever the hell is the natural word, if there is a natural word.
Well, my cock then. My delicious, ever-hungry cock rose a centimeter as her blouse tightened on her breasts. Lord God, we've been humping like warthogs in rutting season for hours and hours and hours. And I was still horny and still in love with her. And I probably always will be. But then again, maybe I'm the Martian. Well, in fact, the old pussy hunter didn't rise more than a millimeter, not a centimeter. And he was as slow as an old man getting out of bed in January. I had just about fucked until my brains came out my ears, even before Harry brought in the hash and wanted to talk. Looking for the Martian. Looking for the governor of Dorn. Looking for the Illuminati. Krishna chasing his tail around the curved space of the Einsteinian universe until he disappears up his own ass. Leaving behind a behind. The back of the void. The Dorn theory of Circa Theosodomonosis.
Own some land,
she continued.
That beautiful black face, like ebon melody. Yes, no painter could show, but Bach could hint the delight of those purple-tinted lips in that black face, saying,
and the government wanted to steal the land, to build a dam.
The inside of her cunt had that purple hue to it also, and there was a tawny beige in her palm, like Caucasian skin. There were so many delights in her body, and in mine, too. Treasures that couldn't be spent in a million years of the most tender and violent fucking.
Hagbard was the engineer hired to build the dam, but when he found out that the Indians would be dispossessed and relocated on less fertile ground, he refused the job.
Eris. Eros spelled sideways.
He broke his contract, so the government sued him,
she said.
That's how he got to be a close friend with the Mohawk.
Which was all pure crap-a-roo. Obviously, Hagbard had gone to court as a lawyer for the Indians, but that one touch of shame in him had kept him from admitting it to Stella, that he had once been a lawyer. So he made up that bit about being the engineer on the dam to explain how he got involved in the case.
He helped them move when they were dispossessed.
I could see bronze men and women moving in twilight, a hill in the background.
This was a long time ago, back in the 50s, I think.
Hagbard was a hell of a lot older than he looked.
One Indian was carrying a raccoon he said was his grandfather. He was a very old man himself. He said grandfather could remember General Washington and how he changed after he became president.
He would be there tonight. That being who had once been George Washington and Adam Weishaupt. He of whom Hitler had said,
"He is already among us. He is intrepid and terrible. I am afraid of him."
Hagbard says he kept thinking of Patrick Henry, the one man who saw what had happened at the Constitutional Convention. It was Henry who had looked at the Constitution and said right away, "I smell a rat." It squints toward monarchy. The old Indian, whose name was Uncle John Feather, said that grandfather, when he was a man, could speak to all animals. He said the Mohawk Nation was more than the living. It was the soul and the soil joined together. When the land was taken, some of the soul died. That was why he couldn't speak to all animals, but only to those who had once been part of his family.
The soul is in the blood, moving the blood. It is in the night especially. Nutley is a typical Catholic-dominated New Jersey town, and the Dorns are Baptists, so I was hemmed in two ways. But even as a boy, I used to walk along the Passaic looking for Indian arrowheads, and the soul would move when I found one. Who was the anthropologist who thought that the Ojibwe believed all rocks were alive? A chief had straightened him out. "Open your eyes," he said, "and you'll see which rocks are alive." We haven't had our Frobenius yet. American anthropology is like virgins writing about sex.
"I know who the Martian is,"
Coyne crooned in a sing-song.
"But I'm not telling. Not yet."
That man, who was either the most successful or the most unsuccessful assassin of the 20th century, and who had raped me, which was supposed to destroy my manhood forever, according to some idiots, was smashed out of his skull, and he looked so happy that I was happy for him.
Hagbard,
Stella went on,
stood there like a tree. He was paralyzed. Finally, old Uncle John Feather asked what was the matter.
Stella leaned forward, her face more richly black against the golden octopus on the wall.
Hagbard had foreseen the ecological catastrophe. He had seen the rise of the welfare state, warrior liberalism, as he calls it, and the spread of Marxism out of Russia across the world. He saw why it all had to happen, with or without the Illuminati helping it along. He understood the snafu principle.
He had worked all that night, after explaining to Uncle John Feather that he was troubled in his heart at the tragedy of the Mohawk. Not mentioning the more enormous tragedy coming at the planet, the tragedy which the old man understood already in his own terms. Hard work, carrying pitiful cheap furniture from cabins onto trucks, tying whole households' possessions with tough ropes. He was sweating and winded when they finished shortly before dawn. The next day, he had burned his naturalization papers and put the ashes in an envelope addressed to the President of the United States with a brief note. Everything relevant is ruled irrelevant. Everything material is ruled immaterial. An ex-citizen. The ashes of his Army Reserve discharge went to the Secretary of Defense with a briefer note. Non servium. An ex-slave. That year's income tax form went to the Secretary of the Treasury after he wiped his ass on it. The note said, "Try robbing a poor box. Der Einzige." His fury still mounting, he grabbed his copy of Das Kapital off the bookshelf, smiling bitterly at the memory of his sarcastic marginal notes, scrawled, "Without private property, there is no private life," on the flyleaf, and mailed it to Joseph Stalin in the Kremlin. Then he buzzed his secretary, gave her 3 months' pay in lieu of notice of dismissal, and walked out of his law office forever. He had declared war on all governments of the world. His afternoon was spent giving away his savings, which at that time amounted to $70,000. Some he gave to drunks on the street, some to little boys or little girls in parks. When the stock exchange closed, he was on Wall Street, handing out fat bundles of bills to the wealthiest-looking men he could spot, telling them, "Enjoy it. Before you die, it won't be worth shit." That night, he slept on a bench in Grand Central Terminal. In the morning, flat broke, he signed on as ABS aboard a merchant ship to Norway. That summer, he tramped across Europe, working as a tourist guide, cook, tutor, any odd job that fell his way, but mostly talking and listening about politics. He heard that the Marshall Plan was a sneaky way of robbing Europe under the pretense of helping it, that Stalin would have more trouble with Tito than he had with Trotsky, that the Viet Minh would surrender soon and the French would retake Indochina, that nobody in Germany was a Nazi anymore, that everybody in Germany was still a Nazi, that Dewey would unseat Truman easily. During his last walking tour of Europe, in the 1930s, he had heard that Hitler only wanted Czechoslovakia and would do anything to avoid war with England, that Stalin's troubles with Trotsky would never end, that all Europe would go socialist after the next war, that America would certainly enter the war when it came, that America would certainly stay out of the war when it came. One idea had remained fairly constant, however, and he heard it everywhere. That idea was that more government, tougher government, more honest government, was the answer to all human problems. Hagbard began making notes for the treatise that later became Never Whistle While You're Pissing. He began with a section that he later moved to the middle of the book.
It is now theoretically possible to link the human nervous system into a radio network so that, micro-miniaturized receivers being implanted in people's brains, the messages coming out of these radios would be indistinguishable to the subjects from the voice of their own thoughts. One central transmitter located in the nation's capital could broadcast all day long what the authorities wanted the people to believe. The average man on the receiving end of these broadcasts would not even know he was a robot. He would think it was his own voice he was listening to. The average woman could be treated similarly. It is ironic that people will find such a concept both shocking and frightening. Like Orwell's 1984, this is not a fantasy of the future, but a parable of the present. Every citizen in every authoritarian society already has such a radio built into his or her brain. This radio is the little voice that asks each time a desire is formed, "Is it safe? Will my wife, my husband, my boss, my church, my community approve? Will people ridicule and mock me? Will the police come and arrest me?" This little voice the Freudians call the super-ego, with Freud himself vividly characterized as the ego's harsh master. With a more functional approach, Paris, Hefferlein, and Goodman in Gestalt Therapy describe this process as a set of conditioned verbal habits. This set, which is fairly uniform throughout any authoritarian society, determines the actions which will and will not occur there. Let us consider humanity a biogram, the basic DNA blueprint of the human organism and its potentials, united with a logogram, this set of conditioned verbal habits. The biogram has not changed in several hundred thousand years. The logogram is different in each society. When the logogram reinforces the biogram, we have a libertarian society, such as still can be found among some American Indian tribes. Like Confucianism before it became authoritarian and rigidified, American Indian ethics is based on speaking from the heart and acting from the heart, that is, from the biogram. No authoritarian society can tolerate this. All authority is based on conditioning men and women to act from the logogram, since the logogram is a set created by those in authority. Every authoritarian logogram divides society, as it divides the individual, into alienated halves. Those at the bottom suffer what I call the burden of nescience. the natural sensory activity of the biogram, what the person sees, hears, smells, tastes, feels, and, above all, what the organism as a whole, or as a potential whole, wants, is always irrelevant and immaterial. The authoritarian logogram, not the field of sensed experience, determines what is relevant and material. This is as true of a highly paid advertising copywriter as it is of an engine lathe operator. The person acts not on personal experience and the evaluations of the nervous system, but on the orders from above. Thus, personal experience and personal judgment being non-operational, these functions become also less real. They exist, if at all, only in that fantasy land which Freud called the unconscious. Since nobody has found a way to prove that the Freudian unconscious really exists, it can be doubted that personal experience and personal judgment exist. It is an act of faith to assume they do. The organism has become, as Marx said, a tool, a machine, a robot. Those at the top of the authoritarian pyramid, however, suffer an equal and opposite burden of omniscience. All that is forbidden to the servile class, the web of perception, evaluation, and participation in the sensed universe, is demanded of the members of the master class. They must attempt to do the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and decision-making for the whole society. But a man with a gun is told only that which people assume will not provoke him to pull the trigger. Since all authority and government are based on force, the master class, with its burden of omniscience, faces the servile class, with its burden of nescience, precisely as a highwayman faces his victim. Communication is possible only between equals. The master class never abstracts enough information from the servile class to know what is actually going on in the world where the actual productivity of society occurs. Furthermore, the logogram of any authoritarian society remains fairly inflexible as time passes, but everything else in the universe constantly changes. The result can only be progressive disorientation among the rulers. The end is debacle. The schizophrenia of authoritarianism exists both in the individual and in the whole society. I call this the snafu principle.
That autumn, Hagbard settled in Rome. He worked as a tourist guide, amusing himself by combining authentic Roman history with Cecil B. DeMille. None of the tourists ever caught him out. He also spent long hours scrutinizing the published reports of Interpol. His Wanderjahr was ending. He was preparing for action. Never subject to guilt or masochism, he had one reason only for his dispersal of his savings: to prove to himself what he intended to do could be done starting from zero. When winter arrived, his studies were complete. Interpol's crime statistics had very kindly provided him with a list of those commodities which, either because of tariffs intended to stifle competition or because of morals laws, could become the foundation of a successful career in smuggling. 1 year later, in the Hotel Claridge on 44th Street in New York, Hagbard was placed under arrest by two U.S. narcotics agents named Galley and Eichmann.
"Well, don't take it too hard,"
Galley said.
"We're only following orders."
"Ah, it's okay,"
Hagbard said.
"Don't feel guilty, but what are you going to do with my cats?"
Galley knelt on the floor and examined the kittens thoughtfully, scratching one under the chin, rubbing the ear of the other.
"What's their names?"
he asked.
"The male is called Vagina,"
Hagbard said.
"The female I call Penis."
"The male is called what?"
Eichmann asked, blinking.
"The male is Vagina and the female is Penis,"
Hagbard said innocently.
"But there's a metaphysic behind it. First, you have to ask yourself, which appeared earlier on this planet, life or death? Have you ever thought about that?"
"Well, this guy's nuts,"
Galley told Eichmann.
"You've got to realize,"
Hagbard went on,
"that life is a coming apart and death is a coming together. Does that help?"
"I never know whether Hagbard is talking profundity or asininity,"
George said dreamily, toking away.
"Reincarnation works backward in time,"
Hagbard went on as the narcs opened drawers and peered under chairs.
"You always get reborn into an earlier historical period. Mussolini, is a witch in the 14th century now and catching hell from the Inquisitors for his bum karma in this age. People who remember the past are all deluded. The only ones who really remember past incarnations remember the future, and they become science fiction writers.
A little old lady from Chicago walked into George's room with a collection can marked Mother's March Against Phimosis. He gave her a dime and she thanked him and left. After the door closed, George wondered if she had been a hallucination or just a woman who had fallen through a space-time warp and landed on the Leif Erikson.
"What the hell are these?"
Eichmann asked. He had been searching Hagbard's closet and found some red, white, and blue bumper stickers. The top half of each letter was blue with white stars, and the bottom half was red and white stripes. They looked patriotic as all get out. The slogan formed this way was, "Legalize abortion, pregnancy is a Jewish plot." Hagbard had been circulating these in neighborhoods like the Yorkville section of Manhattan, the western suburbs of Chicago, and other places where old-fashioned Father Coughlin, Joe McCarthy-style Irish Catholic fascism was still strong. This was a trial run on the logogram-biogram double-bind tactic, out of which the Dalai Lama later developed Operation Mindfuck.
"Patriotic stickers,"
Hagbard explained.
"Well, they look patriotic,"
Eichmann conceded dubiously.
"Did a little woman from Chicago just walk through this room?"
George asked.
"No,"
Harry Coyne said, toking again.
"I didn't see any woman from Chicago, but I know who the Martian is."
"What the hell are these?"
Galley asked. He had found some business-sized cards saying red in green letters and green in red letters.
"When you're out of it all the way on the mountain,"
George asked,
"that's neither the biogram nor the logogram, right? What the hell is it, then?"
"An antigram,"
Hagbard explained, still helpful.
"The cards are an antigram?"
Eichmann repeated, bewildered.
"I may have to place you under arrest and take you downtown,"
Hagbard warned.
"You've both been very naughty boys, breaking and entering, pointing a gun at me. That's technically assault with a deadly weapon. Seizing my narcotics, that's theft. All sorts of invasion of privacy. Very, very naughty."
"You can't arrest us,"
Eichmann whined.
"We're supposed to arrest you."
"Which is red and which is green?"
Hagbard asked.
"Look again."
They looked, and red was now really red and green was really green. Actually, the tints changed according to the angle at which Hagbard held the card, but he wasn't giving away his secrets to them.
"I can also change up and down,"
he added.
"Worse yet, I clog zippers. Neither one of you can open your fly right now, for instance. My real gimmick, though, is reversing revolvers. Try to shoot me and the bullets will come out the back and you'll never use your good right hand again. Try it and see if I'm bluffing."
"Can't you go a little easy on us, officer?"
Eichmann took out his wallet.
"A cop's salary ain't the greatest in the world, eh?"
He nudged Hagbard insinuatingly.
"Are you trying to bribe me?"
Hagbard asked sternly.